Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're,
And interestingly, a lower court initially agreed with them. They leaned on this idea of a constitutional right to be let alone.
Oh, interesting. Right to be let alone.
Yeah, it's a concept, you know, not explicitly written down, but it suggests a zone of personal autonomy free from government intrusion. It's a fascinating starting point, the idea that the government can't just dictate personal choices without a really compelling reason.
So the initial ruling was essentially my choice, my ride, my head. Sort of.
That's pretty much the gist of it, yeah. They argued the helmet law unduly interfered with their personal liberty, their right to decide about their own safety.
Right.
But the state of Florida appealed this, took it up to the Florida Supreme Court, and this is where the key legal analysis really happens.
Okay.
The Florida Supreme Court ultimately reversed that lower court's decision. They placed significant weight on the state's duty to protect the health and safety of its citizens.
Right. So the core tension we're looking at is this. The individual's freedom to make their own choices, even potentially risky ones, versus the state's responsibility to step in for the greater good. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even for the individual's own good in some cases.
Precisely. The central legal question in Idle just boils down to whether the state has the constitutional authority to mandate helmet use for motorcyclists, or if such a requirement, you know, oversteps the boundaries of the governmental power.
And the plaintiffs, they raised several constitutional arguments, right, to challenge the law.
They did. Let's break those down.
Okay. What were the specific constitutional grounds they argued?
They primarily based their challenge on three key constitutional amendments. First, they argued a violation of their First Amendment rights, suggesting the helmet law somehow restricted their freedom of self-expression.
Self-expression. How so?
Well, the court didn't really dig deep into this one, but the idea might have been, maybe, that helmets altered their appearance or ability to express themselves through their riding style. It seems a bit tenuous.
Yeah, maybe a bit of a stretch. Okay, what else?
Second, they invoked the Ninth Amendment. That's the one that reminds us that just because some rights are listed in the Constitution doesn't mean other unenumerated rights don't exist.
Ah, right.
They argued that this right to be let alone fell under that category. An unenumerated right.
Okay. And the third?
Finally, they challenged the law under the 14th Amendment. They raised concerns about both the fairness and reasonableness of the law itself, and also equal protection, although the equal protection argument wasn't really the main focus of the court's analysis in the end.
So they really threw the constitutional kitchen sink at this law, huh?
Pretty much.
But the Florida Supreme Court didn't buy all of it, as we know. Which of these arguments did the court really hone in on in their decision?
Well, while they considered all three, their primary focus was definitely on the 14th Amendment's due process clause.
Okay. Due process.
Yeah, yeah. The central question they grappled with was whether the helmet law was a reasonable exercise of the state's police power.
Police power? Maybe you clarify that for listeners. It's not just about, like, cops on the beat, right?
No, exactly. Good point. Police power in this legal context is the inherent authority of state governments to enact laws and regulations to protect the health, safety, and general welfare of their citizens. Think of it as the state's power to act in the best interests of its population, broadly speaking.
Got it. So the court is essentially asking, is this helmet law a legitimate and reasonable way for Florida to protect its citizens' well-being?
Exactly. And in answering that, the majority opinion, which was written by Justice Mann, outlined several key factors that led them to uphold the helmet law. The first, and arguably the most impactful, was the documented real danger of head injuries in motorcycle accidents.
Right, the data.
Yeah, the court presented some really compelling statistical evidence.
Let's hear those numbers. What kind of data were they looking at?
Well, the data presented showed that a staggering 77% of all motorcycle accident fatalities involved head injuries.
77%.
Wow. Yeah. And furthermore, they cited a New York legislative report which noted that 89.2% of motorcycle accidents resulted in either injury or death.
89%.
And head injuries were a primary cause of those fatalities, often preventable or, you know, significantly less severe with a proper helmet. These numbers really paint a clear picture of the risks.
Wow, those are stark figures. It really highlights the potential for severe harm. So, okay, the court saw a significant demonstrable danger. What other factors weighed into their decision?
Another crucial element was the court's assessment of the minimal inconvenience of wearing a helmet when weighed against that potential for catastrophic harm.
Minimal inconvenience.
Their reasoning was essentially that the relatively minor burden of wearing a helmet, maybe some discomfort, maybe a perceived restriction on personal style, was just a small price to pay for a significant reduction in the risk of death or severe life-altering brain injury.
Makes sense when you put it that way.
They also heavily emphasized the state interest, which goes beyond just the individual motorcyclist. The state has an interest in protecting citizens from harm, sure, but also in mitigating the broader societal costs.
Like what?
Well, things like increased burdens on public healthcare systems, emergency services, and even the economic impact on families and communities when someone suffers a severe preventable injury.
That makes perfect sense. It's not just about the individual rider. There's a ripple effect on society as a whole.
Precisely. And the court also looked at the clarity of the statute itself. They found the law wasn't ambiguous. It provided clear rules for compliance.
Okay.
So motorcyclists knew exactly what was required. This kind of addresses potential due process concerns about fair notice of the law, you know?
Right. No vagueness issues. Now, I recall reading that the court even brought up John Stuart Mill in their decision. That seems a bit unexpected in a case about traffic safety. What was the connection there?
It is fascinating, isn't it? And quite insightful. The court specifically referenced Mill's famous essay on liberty. Interestingly, the plaintiff's lawyer had actually cited Mill to support their right to be let alone argument.
Oh, really? So how did the court use it?
Well, the court cleverly turned Mill's own philosophy to support their position. They quoted his observation that no person is an entirely isolated being. It is impossible for a person to do anything seriously or permanently hurtful to himself without mischief reaching at least to his near connections and often far beyond them.
Ah, so even this great champion of individual liberty recognize that our actions have consequences that extend beyond ourselves.
Right, exactly. And the court really hammered this point home with a particularly powerful statement. They said, "We cannot leave a crashed cyclist lying in the road."
Oof, yeah.
"The legislature may constitutionally conclude that the cyclist's right to be let alone is no more precious than the corresponding right of ambulance drivers, nurses, and neurosurgeons."
Wow. That quote really encapsulates the court's view, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That the state's interest in preventing harm and managing the consequences just outweighs the individual's asserted right to ride without a helmet.
It really does. It's very direct.
So putting all this together, the stats, the minimal burden argument, the state's interest, even the nod to Mill, the Florida Supreme Court ultimately concluded that, yes, the state can mandate helmet use.
Correct. And State v. Idle has since become a really significant legal precedent. It influenced the development and upholding of helmet laws across the U.S.
Right.
It firmly established the principle that states have the authority to prioritize public safety through reasonable regulations, even if those regulations put some limits on personal autonomy. The key is that the law must be a reasonable means to address a demonstrable danger and serve a legitimate state interest.
So it really boils down to this balancing act that we keep coming back to, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The seriousness of the potential harm the state is trying to prevent weighed against the degree of intrusion on individual liberty, all under the umbrella of a legitimate state interest.
Precisely. And Idle offers a clear illustration of how courts undertake this delicate balancing test, especially with laws aimed at preventing injury and death. It underscores that while rights like privacy and autonomy are fundamental, they aren't absolute. They can be subject to reasonable limitations when faced with compelling public interests.
This has been a really insightful deep dive, a case that, you know, at first glance, seems quite narrow, but actually opens up a whole lot about the fundamental relationship between the individual and the state.
Mm-hmm.
For you listening, especially you're studying law, State v. Idle is a fantastic case to keep in mind. It's a great example of how courts analyze these core constitutional questions and how empirical evidence and broader philosophical arguments can inform legal analysis of seemingly straightforward rules.
Indeed. It serves as a powerful reminder that legal analysis often involves carefully weighing competing values and interests. This case clearly demonstrates the judiciary's role in defining the permissible boundaries of state action when it's taken in the name of public welfare.
So as you continue to delve into your legal studies, I want you to consider this. Where do you think that crucial line should be drawn between the state's responsibility to protect and an individual's right to make their own choices? Even risky ones.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
And how might the principles from Idle dealing with helmets back in 69, still resonate and apply to contemporary legal debates on issues far beyond traffic safety today. Definitely something to think about long after this deep dive is over. Thanks for joining us.